Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, President Donald Trump has condemned the most recent suspected chemical weapons attack in Syria. Trump said he would make major decisions within 24 to 48 hours about how the United States would react. The president told his cabinet that the U.S. would learn who was responsible for the attack, whether it was Syria, Russia, Iran, or all of them together. "We are looking at that very strongly, very seriously," he said. At least 40 people were reported killed in the suspected attack Saturday. It happened in a rebel-held area near Damascus. Russia said there is no evidence Syria carried out such an attack. Earlier Monday, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said the United States is not ruling out military action against Syria. Mattis spoke to reporters Monday during a meeting with Qatari leader Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani at the Defense Department's headquarters near Washington. Mattis said that the U.S. is working with our allies and partners from NATO to Qatar and elsewhere. We are going to address this issue. He said the U.S. and its allies want to know why chemical weapons use continues after Russia guaranteed the removal of all such weapons from Syria. Syria's government has denied using chemical weapons throughout the Syrian conflict, which began in 2011. Sunday night, the Trump administration reported about a telephone call between the president and French President Emmanuel Macron. It said the two leaders strongly condemned chemical attacks in Syria. They reportedly agreed that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's government must be held accountable for its continued human rights abuses. The U.S. president has blamed the Syrian leader for the attack. On Sunday, Trump also criticized Russian President Vladimir Putin. He wrote on Twitter that President Putin, Russia, and Iran are responsible for their support of, in his words, animal Assad. Also, Syria and Russia say two Israeli military airplanes carried out an attack Monday morning on an airbase in central Syria. They said the planes were operating in Lebanese airspace. Israel's military did not comment on the report. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the attack killed 14 people, including Iranian forces. On Saturday, medical emergency crews said they found families suffocated in their homes and shelters near Damascus. They said the victims had foam on their mouths. Workers said more than 500 people, mostly women and children, were brought to medical centers. They all had difficulty breathing, foaming at the mouth, and burning eyes. The Civil Defense and Syrian American Medical Society said the patients gave off a chlorine-like smell. It noted that some had blue skin, evidence of a lack of oxygen.
At Boston Medical Center, patients recovering from drug dependencies are getting healthier one meal at a time. For years, the hospital has offered cooking classes for patients with medical conditions, such as heart disease. It also runs a food store for poor patients who receive fresh food as part of their treatments. The newest class is Cooking for Recovery. It is connected to the spreading belief that many forms of treatment are needed to recover from drug and alcohol dependency, also called addiction. Michael Botticelli is the head of the medical center's Graykin Center for Addiction and former director of the government's Office of National Drug Control Policy. He says recovery is not just about stopping the use of alcohol and drugs. It's about how do we return people to a sense of wellness and a sense of well-being. On a recent Thursday, cook Tracy Berg taught patients how to make a meal of chicken and vegetables. Mood enhancers, vegetables and whole grains, set on the side on one side of the table. Mood depressors, foods with a lot of sugar, set on the other side. Good healthy eating is often forgotten during recovery, Berg said, and many addicts desire sugary foods that affect the same areas of the brain as drugs, she said. This can lead to rising and falling blood sugar levels, depression, and possible return to drug use. Berg said, many addicts have serious stomach problems because much of the organs' healthy bacteria have been destroyed. She teaches that eating fiber can improve bacteria health. Felicia Young has been in recovery for about a year and a half. She heard about the cooking class from her doctor. She knows how to cook a little, but wanted more information. She added that she likes the activity that takes place in the class. Young said the hospital's addiction treatment program has helped her return to normal life. But, she said, she had not considered how healthy eating could affect her until she attended the class. I didn't even know that it could be part of recovery, she said. Some other addiction treatment centers have experts that run healthy eating programs for patients. But officials at Boston Medical Center said they did not know of any that include cooking classes. That may change. New Hampshire's Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center has taken note of the cooking classes. Its addiction treatment program for pregnant women and mothers includes a food store. Patients can take home fresh fruits and vegetables after recovery group meetings. Upper Valley Haven runs the store. The nonprofit organization in Vermont offers food, housing, and other support to poor people. Organization officials there visited the Boston Medical Center kitchen and food store seeking new ideas. Dartmouth Hitchcock is working with patients to write a cookbook of healthy recipes, Goodman said. I'm Susan Shand. Thank you.
From VOA, Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. As spring comes to half the world, many people can enjoy the new growth that comes with warmer weather. This is a great time to get outside and get dirty. Gardening is popular in many parts of the world. This outdoor activity gives us beautiful plants, pleasant-smelling flowers, and fresh fruits and vegetables. But it also gives us many health benefits. Gardening connects people. When you are gardening, you are outdoors. So it is a perfect time to socialize with your neighbors. Most people love to talk about their hobbies, and gardeners are no different. They enjoy showing people what they are growing, and most enjoy sharing advice and stories about their gardens almost as much as sharing herbs, flowers, and vegetables from their gardens. Gardening can greatly widen a person's community. Some people may not have the resources to have their own garden, so many cities and towns have community gardens. You can either volunteer or just visit to learn more. Check what resources are available to you in your area. If there are no community gardens near you, there may be government money available to help you start one. Gardening is a great activity to do with children. It gets families outdoors and off computers, televisions, and other electronics. Gardening can be a great teacher. Children can learn about nature and wildlife. Gardening can teach a child about where food comes from and healthy eating. It can also help them to understand the limits of natural resources and the importance of using them carefully. When you are in your garden, you might feel the sunshine on your skin. This means you are getting vitamin D. Vitamin D helps our bodies use calcium that is necessary to keep bones strong. Vitamin D also helps us fight diseases. Also, when you garden, you must move around. All the different movements needed for gardening, bending, twisting, stretching, and lifting, work small muscles in the body. And you can easily get a good workout when you are digging holes or pulling weeds. Gardening may also help you to feel calm and happy. A study by researchers in the Netherlands found that gardening may reduce the stress hormone cortisol in the brain. Scientists say that high levels of cortisol in the body interfere with learning and memory. It can also increase a person's weight, blood pressure, and cholesterol levels. Chronic high levels of cortisol increase the risk for depression, mental illness, and lower life expectancy. In the study, the researchers gave 30 gardeners a difficult, stressful task. After completing the task, researchers measured their cortisol levels. The gardeners self-reported on their mood or how they felt emotionally. Then the gardeners were asked to recover by either gardening outdoors or reading indoors for 30 minutes. Both activities led to lower cortisol levels. However, the decreases were stronger in the gardening group. Also, those who gardened reported that their good moods returned fully. The readers found that their bad moods only got worse. Gardening may help your brain stay young. In another study in 2006, researchers looked at more than 2,800 people over the age of 60. They studied their lifestyle habits, activities, and health over a 16-year period. They found that gardening could lower risk of future dementia by 36%. Activities such as gardening uses many repeated actions, such as weeding or deadheading, removing dying flowers from a plant. These actions have a calming effect on the brain. The brain is still active, but not in the same way that it is, say, when we use computers. In our technology-filled lives, gardening offers a chance to unplug. You cannot hold a phone or other electronic devices when your hands are filled with dirt. Gardening can also give you the feeling that you have done something good. A flower and herb garden can help feed bees and butterflies. Growing herbs and flowers, even in a couple of pots at your city home, connects you to nature and pleases all of your senses. What you grow in a garden usually looks, smells, feels, and tastes really good. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Ulysses Grant was elected President of the United States in 1868. Grant was a military hero. He led Union troops of the North to victory over Confederate troops of the South in the Civil War. Grant was extremely popular, but he was a much better general than he was a politician. As president, it was not long before he got into trouble in the battles of politics and government. Larry West and Frank Oliver talk about the first term of President Ulysses Grant.
Grant resigned from the army to run for president. However, he ran on his record as a winning general. "Let us have peace," he often said, and the people believed he would guarantee peace. In fact, Grant guaranteed nothing. As a presidential candidate, he offered no new national programs. So, as president, he had no new policies to carry out. He had few struggles with Congress, because he rarely asked Congress to do anything. Many events took place during Grant's two administrations, but he usually was not involved directly. He had problems only because he was linked indirectly to the men who were responsible.
One of President Grant's first problems was caused by two of his friends. They tried to take control of the gold market. The men were Jay Gould and James Fisk. Both were extremely rich. Gould and Fisk developed a plan to buy a large part of the nation's gold supply when the price was low. They would hold the gold until demand greatly increased the price. Then they would sell it and make a lot of money. To be successful, they had to prevent the government from selling gold on the market. Government sales of gold would keep the price down. So Gould and Fisk urged President Grant to stop the Treasury Department from selling gold. Grant refused to give them a firm promise.
The two men brought one of Grant's relatives into their plan. They paid him to write a letter to the president. It asked the president to halt government sales of gold. A messenger took the letter to the White House. He then sent a telegram to James Fisk, saying the letter had been delivered. The telegram said, "Letter delivered. All right." Fisk thought this meant that President Grant had agreed to halt government sales of gold. So he began buying gold in huge amounts. Fisk was wrong. The words, "all right," meant only that the letter had been delivered. They did not mean that Grant had agreed to the plan. In fact, Grant did not agree. He ordered the Treasury Department to sell gold to block the attempt by Gould and Fisk to control the gold market.
The result was that James Fisk and Jay Gould lost a great amount of money. So did other businessmen and bankers. Many Americans blamed President Grant for not acting quickly enough to stop the activity of his two friends. Concern about Grant grew after another incident was reported at the New York Customs Office. Two of Grant's friends there became involved in a plan to get money from importers. They used their official positions to earn huge amounts of money.
Grant also was criticized for one of his few independent actions as president. He tried to buy the Dominican Republic in the Caribbean. The island nation was ruled by a dictator, Buenaventura Báez. Báez was so dishonest that the people of the Dominican Republic were ready to overthrow him. Before this could happen, he offered to sell his country to the United States. When Grant received the offer, he sent a White House official to negotiate with Báez. The official returned with a treaty giving the Dominican Republic to the United States for $1.5 million. Grant immediately sent American warships to the Dominican Republic. He wanted to keep Báez in power until the treaty was completed. Grant asked the Senate to approve the treaty. Many senators opposed it. They said taking control of the Dominican Republic would cost too much money. They also said it was a bad idea for the United States to take control of any nation in the Caribbean. President Grant went to the Capitol building himself to urge senators to approve the treaty. His efforts failed. The treaty was defeated.
Grant's biggest national problem was the political situation in the former rebel states of the South. After the Civil War, most Southern states were governed by radical members of the Republican Party. Radicals supported citizenship rights and voting rights for blacks. In the late 1860s, the radicals began to lose power. Many failed to be reelected to state office. They were being defeated by candidates of the Democratic Party. Democrats did not want blacks to have any rights at all.
The first radical Republicans to lose power were those in Virginia. The change there was made peacefully. Not so in other Southern states. In Tennessee, Georgia, and North Carolina, Democrats used threats and violence to win elections. Their campaigns often were led by members of the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan was a secret organization of white men. Members believed white people were greater than black people. Wearing cloths over their faces, Klansmen broke up radical Republican political meetings. They threatened, beat, and killed blacks to keep them out of politics. They did the same thing to whites who tried to organize or help blacks.
Before long, Ku Klux Klan groups were formed in every southern state. By 1871, radical Republican congressmen were demanding a new law to destroy the Ku Klux Klan. A committee headed by radicals was named to investigate Klan activities in the South. The committee heard reports of the Klan's brutal acts. It helped prepare a bill to control the Klan. After much debate, Congress passed the bill. The new law gave the president power to declare military rule in the South. Democrats charged that the real purpose of the law was to keep radical Republican state governments in power. President Grant did not wait long to use his powers under the new law. He declared military rule in a large area of South Carolina. Thousands of people there were arrested. They were tried in federal courts. Juries were made up mainly of blacks and radical whites.
This kind of justice made Southerners feel even more bitterness toward the North. It also angered a number of moderate members of the Republican Party. They said the federal government should not help radical Republicans stay in power in the South. Some of these moderate Republicans broke away from President Grant and the radicals. They called themselves liberal Republicans and formed a new political party. They held their own presidential nominating convention for the election of 1872. They nominated Horace Greeley as their candidate. Greeley published the New York Tribune newspaper.
Democrats believed their only chance to win the election was to support the new liberal Republicans. So they, too, chose Horace Greeley as their presidential candidate. As expected, the radicals who controlled the main Republican Party nominated Grant for a second term. The campaign between Grant and Greeley was very strange. Grant made no speeches. He spent the summer at a holiday town on the Atlantic Ocean coast. His supporters, however, were not silent. They called Greeley a fool and a traitor. They refused to treat him as a serious candidate. Unlike Grant, Greeley did campaign hard, but he had little financial help. He also was hurt by a poorly organized campaign.
On Election Day in 1872, Ulysses Grant won a big victory. He got the votes of 31 of the 37 states. Horace Greeley died 3 weeks after the election. The new liberal Republican Party died with him. Ulysses Grant and the radical Republicans would govern for another 4 years.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.